Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I have to emphasize, because I've been beaten about the head and neck, that I don't emphasize this enough, because I'm told that this is a huge differentiator between Reclaiming the Republic and all of the other entertaining conservative talk shows. And so what you need to understand is that that debt clock is a fraudulent depiction of our tyranny. Actually, it's an accurate depiction of our tyranny, but it is a facade. We do not owe that money. We have been convinced that because the Constitution says that they have the good faith and credit of the United States, but they only have the good faith and credit in doing those things that are enumerated. They do not have the authority to take on and create any type of contract. Because if you read through the Supremacy Clause, it says right there. Somebody has to actually pull that up, right? And so when we look at the color-coded Constitution, and we go to Section... it's not Section 8, because it's actually going to be Section 6. When we look at the Supremacy Clause for the U.S. Constitution, it's very, very clear. It says this Constitution, I want to see this right, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof. So any law that is made based on the powers, roles, responsibilities, all those things enumerated in this Constitution, all those laws shall be the supreme law of the land. So in other words, they're creating this qualification that all laws which shall be made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. In other words, if it's not enumerated, they cannot create a contract. That contract has no force. The debt that China, these other countries, are basically duping their own citizens by throwing money at the United States to destroy us. This is an economic war that has been created. And I'm hoping you understand this. I'm hoping you understand that our government has been working treasonously, or I shouldn't say our government, our public servants. Our government is we the people and that Constitution. And government that is acting, whenever they're acting. So technically, we have public servants who are actors, and many of the actions that they do are violations. They're treasonous. But every once in a while, they may actually take a fraction of their day and do something that's within their actual constitutional responsibilities. So they're doing some things that, you know, they're supposed to do for us, but the majority of the stuff that they do, they have no authority to do. But they've been told over the past centuries. So this is why we have to really, you know, this is why one of the reasons I don't care. I don't care whether these people are knowingly doing this or not. We have to stop it and get them back into doing those few things that they have the authority to do. I believe that there's plenty of people out there that will pursue that. I only pursue getting us back into the process. I am not calling any people out to be stoned for their sins. I think that that's more important. If you really want your day, you know, want them in court and give them their, you know, their due process. But to be clear, to remove a public servant, they have no right to due process. Because Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not allow them due process. It states right there that if they're violating their oath, they're to be thrown out. The only character, the only actor in our federal or our general government that has the benefit of due process is the president and the vice president, because Section 3 does not include the president or vice president because the impeachment process stands. The reason why Section 3 of the 14th Amendment omits the president and vice president and includes everybody else is because the impeachment process has been established and actually has been exercised. And so it works. With everybody else, there was not a process other than the fact that it was given to each branch of service, whether it be the Senate and or the House of Representatives or even the court system. And even though the good behavior of our judges has been kind of left supposedly to the legislators, they have refused to do their job. So Section 3 basically says, you know what, we're not going to count on them to impeach each other. And Section 3 basically states, if they have violated their oath, they're removed. And so how do we do that? Well, if you articulate an irrefutable argument in a First Amendment petition, and that petition is completely based on the not a judge's interpretation of the Constitution, but it is completely based upon the original terms and definitions of the Constitution. In other words, if you read the petitions that we write and you hear how we call out our public servants must do these things, and if they're not doing those things, then they're directly violating their oath of office. As soon as you tell them that they have to call forth the militia to repel this invasion, then if Congress does not do that, after you've told them to do that, then they have no shot. And as a matter of fact, I think it should be left up to the people in their own. Here's the problem. When we do leave it up to the people in their own congressional districts to say whether that person's representing them that, or, you know, at that point in time, in other words, I believe Nancy Pelosi will never be held accountable by those people who vote her into office. And same thing with AOC. Same thing with all of these hardcore leftists who are voting them in. It's the same thing with the right. So I think what will end up happening is that we will need other people to bring forth the justice and charges, because it doesn't have to come from the district. You know, you don't need necessarily a vote of confidence. This is why I think people need to get it into their craw, whether they like it or not, that we do have kind of this Christian opportunity of giving them one warning, one bit of forgiveness. I forgive you of this sin that you've committed. However, you have no choice anymore. Call forth the militia, repel the invasion, get these invaders out, shut that down, and stop this invasion and repel them. That's what the Constitution demands. Now, actually, I'm hoping to talk to a filmmaker on this border war that we've got. In the near future, we might actually have that interview. But bottom line, that debt is unconstitutional. And so even though these other countries, this is where I was going with this, even though those other countries have, you know, they're legitimately saying that, oh, yeah, this is a legitimate debt, they know that our government does not have the authority. They knew this a long time ago. And because they created an ignorant citizenry, they've been able to get away with it. I chastise people all the time in social media when they make these outrageous talks about, you know, how this debt is going to destroy us. It only destroys us if we let it. As long as you legitimize it, it will destroy us. This is why I know there's a lot of people that love Ron Paul. He has almost a godlike figure to a lot of people. And I know I get hate mail every time I say this, but Ron Paul is equally a part of the problem, because he is obviating the truth. The Federal Reserve is unconstitutional. This is not a legitimate entity. The federal government has never had the authority to do this. And so his call to audit the Fed actually helps legitimize it, and it creates and it obviates the fact that it is illegitimate, because when you call for something to be audited, that means it's a legitimate entity. Does he actually know what he was doing? I don't know. But I can tell you that we do not want to follow Paul and going down that path of auditing the Fed. It only legitimizes them. And getting you to think that we need to audit them, they've convinced you into this fallacy that it's legitimate. I am telling you, if it is not enumerated, and we've already told you that the national bank that the federal government created in the first place was not a constitutional authority. What really it chafes my behind, that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison didn't stand up. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why maybe they didn't do this. I mean, this is only speculation. Until I die and I have the privilege of standing in front of these men, because I do know there is a heaven. I do know that these men are waiting for us. They're waiting for the resurrection. But I would love to ask them why they didn't take the 1798 resolutions and actually do it in 1792. Or 1793 or 4, when they started going down this path of from the Assumption Act into the creation of the first bank. Because the Assumption Act was in 1792. Why did they allow Hamilton to, guile them, to lie to them and deceive them? Why were they allowed to be deceived? There's no doubt in my mind. My head hangs very low for some of the things I wish I never did. And so, and I'm trying to live a life to where I don't have to. As a matter of fact, never mind. I don't want to talk personal stuff. I don't want to get into that. But bottom line, the Supremacy Clause is very, very clear that they do not have the authority to create this fraudulent debt. Now, let me dive into what I really want to get into, because I can't really get into the political exorcism today. What I wanted to do was kind of finish up what I was talking about, because I was almost ready to get into that and getting into the 14th Amendment of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. There's a very good article it was a thesis written by Kurt Lash. And I'm going to read a part of that thesis to help you understand why the 14th Amendment was really passed by the people. You got to understand that it went out to the people and it became literally a campaign mechanism in 1866 during the election year. And so he actually points out, and so I'll read that when we get back to that. But what's more important is I wanted to kind of close the loop on what I was talking about with John Durash, and I'm hoping that we can have another interview. And actually, I'm hoping that we have the privilege of doing a interview series with what we're doing and how you can get directly involved, because the NLA does provide a great education of what has to happen to restore common law. Some of the things that need to be done in restoring common law is how to wrap the common law court system, because there's lots of fallacies that we have to wrap it around the Bible. As I've told you, the framers knew that we didn't have a standard Bible, and they know the problems between the interpretations of the Bible. I mean, it was very clear to James Madison I want you to understand this. During the Constitutional Convention, they were actually hoping to create and establish a religion. And they recognized, and Madison's quip was very, stabbed all of these men in the heart. When he said, which Bible are we going to follow? Which Bible will we create this theocracy for common law? Now, he didn't inject common law there, but he was basically saying, which Bible are we going to follow? Because common law was already declared in all of the states. Ah, not one man actually was willing to actually say, follow my Bible. Because almost everybody in that room, because they were delegates from different states, they knew that their Bible was different. And there was a reason why their Bible was different, because it was better than the other Bibles. And so everybody had their biases based on the doctrines that fit their ideology. They realized this ideology would have destroyed America just like it destroyed Europe. Right? When you look at Europe, Europe was kind of being settled by basically the same set of people. Anglo-Saxons predominantly settled the European nation, because who were the Anglo-Saxons? They came from the Germanic state. And as you look at how things proliferated, it's, you know, it's kind of common that almost everybody understands each other's language in Europe because they have to interplay. It's almost like family. Anyway, I digress. Before I get into that exorcism, I wanted to actually start talking about, you know, this ending point where I left off, because as I pointed out, Britain was a monarchical theocracy, and in our republican form of government, our law is our king. This was clearly articulated by the framers, and no one can argue otherwise, because when they were actually revolting against Britain, they wanted to sever themselves from having a king who could assert authority over the people. This is one of the reasons why they did not want bloodlines. They did not want anything like that at all in America. And look today, folks, we got bloodlines. We got the Clintons, and well, the Obama bloodline doesn't, you know, there's no bloodline there, but we got the Bushes. We had the Roosevelts. We got the Kennedys. We have bloodlines, and we should actually completely stay away from anybody. We really need to make sure that the people that we elect are actually going to support that document and not use popularism and say, I'm going to give you this and I'm going to give you that, because they don't have the authority to do that. Because when we actually awaken from our illiteracy, we will actually be able to see and judge our public servants in what they say and what they do by going after them when they actually exercise authority over things not delegated, over powers, roles, responsibilities, and etc., not enumerated in the Constitution. That is the key. That is our king. What is in the Constitution is what they can do. And it was John Adams. This is what he stated, and this is actually in Why Counties Matter Most, this one little caption here. Because the very definition of a republic is an empire of laws and not of men. That as a republic, that was a quote unquote, an empire of laws and not of men. See, Britain actually was an empire of a family. It was a theocratic family that was coronated. That as a republic is the best of governments, so that particular arrangement of the powers of society, or in other words, that form of government, which is best contrived to secure an impartial and exact execution of the laws, is the best of republics. Of republics, there is an inexhaustible variety, because the possible combinations of the powers of society are capable of innumerable variations. Now, technically, Britain was a constitutional republic. I just want you to understand that Britain was literally a constitutional republic, and in so being one, it was also a theocracy, and it was a republic of men. So it wasn't by happen chance that these guys felt that a republic was the best. They were well educated. You got to remember that this was a part of the enlightenment in society, where they had actually seen the empirical data of democracies and all of these different forms of government. This is why these guys were ideologues on the doctrine of liberty, because they knew what would preserve liberty for people. And I mean this. I want you to understand that these men knew it. This is why some of the things that they stated was so profound, such as John Adams and what he stated. And you'll find that actual citation in John Adams' Thoughts on Government. He wrote that in April 1776, as they were getting ready to actually declare independence. And as a matter of fact, that's, I think, from this, he was injected into the committee that Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams actually wrote. They were in the committee that wrote the Declaration of Independence, but actually it was Thomas Jefferson that just said, I got this. And he went off and wrote it, handed it to him, and they just basically did, they just rubber stamped and sent it out to the body of the whole. Now, on the 4th of July, we always read what Thomas Jefferson actually wrote, because it was political correctness that actually edited and probably cut about a page and a half off that document. There was that much edited off. But anyway, there is nowhere in our current founding documents that retain the doctrine of magistrates. There is also no founding document that points to the sheriff as anything but a defender of the law. Now, what this means is that he must defend the people from those who commit crimes, whether those crimes are by criminals who want to steal your property or do you harm, or by the criminals in government who are trying to steal your liberty or your property through taxation and those types of things. And so if you kind of understand, the sheriff actually has this responsibility of protecting the people in the way of the law. He actually can be a powerful force, but he's not the magistrate. He can't organize the people. He's the commander of the militia, but the commander in our framework of government, the military, is always subjugated to the civilian authority. And who is the civilian authority? Some people would say, well, that's the president. That's the governor. That's the executive of the county. And that executive of the county is controlled by the representatives, our legislators of the county, of the state, and of Congress. This is why the power is vested in Congress to declare war. The president just can't say, I'm grabbing the army. As a matter of fact, the whole concept of the president being able to use executive power quickly in response is almost a violation of the Constitution. I mean, it's one thing for him to have forces abroad, as like the Navy and so forth, because Thomas Jefferson actually sent in the Marines in recovering the ship, I believe, that was taken by the Ottoman Empire in Tripoli. Was he within his bounds? Absolutely. That was American interest. He had that responsibility. He couldn't declare war. He couldn't wage war against a nation, so he had to be in context. The president has to be in context to those things that he actually has power for. He cannot declare war or wage war. Some things can be considered acts of war. He can probably even initiate a potential as it's perceived. And what I mean by that is, as we get really, you know, into the nitty-gritty, when a president actually protects the resources, like what Ronald Reagan did in Grenada, in sending the Marines in, the people of that republic, that banana republic or what have you, the government could have easily said, we consider this an act of war. But they would not have done that, especially with an overwhelming force of the United States. Now, there are all sorts of people around the world that have declared war on the United States, and we have to take that seriously. Every Islamic nation has basically, that calls us the evil Satan and so forth, that's tantamount to a declaration of war. But Thomas Jefferson did exercise those authorities in actually protecting and bringing back the resources and the lives of those people that were held hostage by the Ottoman Empire. So when we come back, we'll actually dive. I'll close this, but I'll let you know we're going to be talking about national security when we come back and our oversight over that.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I'm going to dive into, because it was feedback this past week on my position on Snowden being a hero. These things always come up, and as a matter of fact, I was asked to dive into this, because I've covered this before, and it may not actually be really well documented. So what we're going to do is I'm going to do this, because people need to understand the states have this huge responsibility of oversight, and there's so many different things that we really need to understand, especially intelligence oversight. But let me wrap up, because I want to close this door. I want to shut this door behind me in talking about the Doctrine of Magistrates. Thomas Jefferson. So this is why Thomas Jefferson, in the very beginning of the framing of this nation, literally asserted ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. Again, ignorance of the law, we've heard that one line, ignorance of the law is no excuse, but did you hear him actually say in any country? Somehow it was cut off, because you don't understand the following sentence that he also stated. Ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. If it were, the laws would lose their effect. Because it can always be pretended. Folks, today our law and government is full pretension mode. In other words, they are pretending so much government. Now do you understand why ignorance of the law was necessary for them to continue to do more and more that they had no authority to do? This is how we are the ones that allowed ourselves to be ignorant. We allowed ideologues to get in control of our education system, to dumb us down. This all started with the Fabian Society. Many people have seen the civics and the quality of education in the middle 1800s. Where a child would have a better understanding of civics, our government, and everything else than college graduates today that are lawyers. And so we're in this place because they have taken and have redefined everything throughout the education curriculum to ensure that you can't piece it all together. I'm just absolutely amazed that all of the brilliant minds that I have ran across, because I am not a brilliant man. I just happened to be born with the ability to actually challenge things and analyze things to be able to connect dots. I am not special. As a matter of fact, most of the dots have been connected for me. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we have to start understanding, because remember, our sheriffs are supposed to be these protectors, to protect us from criminals, to ensure that certain laws are not enforced if they're criminal laws. In other words, the laws are the color of law. A law that is the color of law is a criminal law. In other words, it's the lawmakers that made that are the criminals. That's hopefully that's clear. So when you realize that, and as a matter of fact, maybe I need to bring up the citations out of the ratification debates, but we're kind of covering that now. But I want you to understand that your county legislatures have been stolen from you. They are your property. They are your government. They are your representatives. And the best paradigm I can give you is James Madison regarding property. And this is what he said. He says, he has a property of a peculiar value in religious opinions and in his profession and practice dictated by him. He has a property very dear to him in the safety and liberty of his person. He doesn't say it here, but I am telling you that that is your representative. Your representative is to ensure that he behaves within that supreme law. Anyway, he goes on. Madison goes on and says, he has an equal property in the free use of his faculties and free choice of the objects on which to employ them. In a word, a man is said to have a right to his property. It may equally be said to have property in his rights. Actually, not it. Let me restate that. In a word, a man is said to have a right to his property. He may be equally said to have a property in his rights. In other words, when your legislators, who are supposed to be protecting your rights, actually work in taking away your rights, then your legislatures are stealing your property. And this ignorance, because these guys that go in there to represent you, they actually are doing that because they have no idea that they can't do that. Just remember, folks, the Ninth Amendment protects us from any and all enumerations. No enumeration can be construed to deny you or disparage you from rights, inalienable rights, that might be enumerated. In other words, even though there may be something enumerated within the Constitution, they cannot take away or disparage you those rights that are retained by you. In other words, your parental rights. And we're seeing that these are the exact things that they're doing. They're taking inalienable rights that may not be actually listed, but by enumerations that they've created this authority over the children that they can take away all your parental rights. They can't. The Ninth Amendment protects you from that. This is what Madison also said. Where an excess of power prevails, property is no sort is duly respected. No man is safe in his opinion, his person, his faculties, or his possessions. Where an excess of power prevails, property of no sort is duly respected. No man is safe in his opinions, his person, his faculties, or his possessions. End of story. So Madison hits it out of the park right here. This is how they are pretending. Folks, if I am wrong regarding this doctrine of magistrates, then give me the evidence in our founding documents that proves we retained this British theocracy and the King James Version of the Bible, right? Because that has to be documented somewhere, that they've retained that theocracy and the doctrine of magistrates. Now, I have no doubt, and I am fully confident, that many Christians would love to be living in a biblical theocracy. This gives them comfort, but this is not confined or constrained from the states. It is confined and constrained from the federal government. In other words, your states can actually have established religions. The federal government is the one that is constrained from doing that. And this is because of the 14th Amendment, the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Remember what that one clause says. No state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. Now, if your state, in back in the days of the Constitution, every state in the Union, and as a matter of fact, when people say this was a Christian nation, it didn't mean we were a Christian nation in theocracy. It was a nation made up of Christians, and the states were all Christian states. Because all 13 states actually had a state-sponsored religion. This has been well documented. And as a matter of fact, religion was equally involved in every state because it was the religion that took care of compassionate services. Madison pointed this out in the debate on the bounty of the cod fishery bounties in the 1792 discourse. In Congress, while he was a representative, he basically pointed that they couldn't use the public purse to actually be paying for the bounties and those types of things based on welfare, because he says as soon as you start doing that, then you could actually completely pervert the Constitution, but you could start justifying using the public purse to take over education, health care, and all of these types of things that are not enumerated. He pointed out that that was a direct violation of how that clause was established in the ratification debates as a preamble to the foregoing powers, not to the foregoing, the preceding powers. In the following powers that were listed, the General Defense and Welfare Clause, right there in Article 1, Section 8, is basically laying out that these following powers are provided for the general welfare and defense of the United States. It was a preamble. It wasn't a delegation of general powers at all. And this was clarified during the ratification debates by many of the framers. By the Federalists. The Anti-Federalists kept on saying, no, that's a general power. And they said, no, it's not. That is a preamble. Or the list of powers following would not be necessary. Then, because they create the list, those are the enumerated powers, period. It was strictly a preamble. In other words, something that explained the following things. And that's exactly what it did. So, your state can actually establish a religion. It just can't force that religious expressions and practices upon the people, but they can utilize. And so what should have happened, and this probably goes into a longer conversation, I'll try to curtail it right here, that what should have happened when the churches started getting away from a single church, a single Christian faith, they should have actually been open to allowing all of the different faiths competition and a fair competition so there's ways of doing that, but I don't want to discuss it because it would take me probably a couple of shows to dive into that. And the best way to do that would be in an interview with somebody so that we could, you know, really ferret through this process, because at this point in time, at best, this is a true ideology that I believe we need to return to, giving the church responsibilities in our communities and in our lives. But how to do that, and the best way to do that, really does need to be worked out. I'm not a king. I'm not trying to establish anything. But I believe reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. And there's no doubt in my mind we would have an enlightened society if we created a symbiotic relationship with the Christian churches that existed. Because Christianity embraces enlightenment. Anyway, and as a matter of fact, Sir Isaac Newton really talked very heavily about that type of stuff. But before I dive into this exorcism, like I said, I wanted to talk about this concept of national security. Most people have no clue about national security. And when you've been briefed into, you know, all these different classified levels, you know, as a matter of fact, most people don't even understand, because they think, oh, well, you can get into government channels. There's no way. many of these channels are so well guarded with cryptography that you, even if you intercepted it, you would not be able to decipher it. It is that good in encryption. So when people say, well, they hacked into government systems, what they've actually hacked into were the open systems that are out there. And so, and I don't want to get into all of that. But my point is that there are these different levels, what they would call for official use only or GENSER traffic. Those are confined networks and systems that one, when you get into classified at the GENSER level, it is protected. There are levels of encryption and so forth, and or measures of protection that you really can't hack into. You can get some stuff, and believe it or not, the reason why some stuff is getting exposed is people like Hillary Clinton, who should have actually gone to jail. She should have been tried for treason because she had no business actually having and sending out an open email. When you look at what's happening to Trump and his holdings, his physical holdings of documents, he wasn't transmitting those over an electric line. He may have had some that actually, you know, in all of this stuff that he had that they just, you know, took out of the White House and put it down in Key Largo, then that, you know, did he actually pack those boxes? No. But there still should be some accountability. So whoever was responsible for going through that, that person should be fired, period. There's no way in my mind that I could even think that President Trump was packing boxes. It's the same thing with this dolt. Now, I'll actually say that there could be more reliability in Biden actually having, because he tucked those classified documents into his Corvette. I can't believe that somebody did that for him. I believe that he actually stowed those things away for a purpose. And there is a huge difference between Trump having this big, huge repository of documentation, within it some classified, to within a personal car, a small set of classified documents. So there's no doubt in my mind what, you know, what you're seeing in the system is completely unfair. But what Snowden did and what other people do when they expose our sources, our methods, that is treasonous. We do have a need for having intelligence, but we have to have an incredible oversight system. As they have grown, remember, this is all stemming from our ignorance. The reason why is because we're told, oh, well, the intelligence system actually protects us because they have their own oversight. Congress is an oversight. And I'm telling you that when both hands are corrupt, you can really wage warfare. This is how FISA warrants have been done. This is how this volume collection of American citizens, of their communications, that should never be happening. Should never be happening. And it's the state's responsibility. And really, when it comes down to it, it's we the people. If you're really upset about what Snowden did, or actually what was happening because Snowden made it aware of everybody, then you should actually be seeking a real solution, not more people divulging sources, methods, and so forth. The real solution is empowering your state legislatures with complete oversight. In other words, what should have happened is when somebody actually is working within the intelligence system and they realize that the federal government in their intelligence operations is violating, or they believe this is a violation of the Constitution. You just don't go take this information to the press. That would be treasonous. I believe the due diligence and the responsibility of that person working as a citizen of the United States who is obligated to support the Constitution should take that information and walk into a state legislature's office. or I should say, into the state legislature. They would have this little dossier. And all they needed to say is, I need to speak to somebody in the SCIF. And so that's all they need to do. And they would go into the SCIF, and there would be a team of legislators. This could be bipartisan. I don't care. I really don't care, but it has to be a team. You have to have multiple people, and those people have to be changing, and it has to be kind of like a duty thing, you know, where these people are... There's a reason why there's a term called TPI, two-person integrity, because if one person is completely trusted, it's been proven that they will actually think otherwise. But when you have two people that actually have the access, so in other words, one person can't gain full access to the classified information, like our cryptology. It's a TPI thing. In other words, one person has one combination to the drawer, and another combination of a hasp that holds that drawer secure. So in other words, there's literally two combinations that one person has and another person has the other one. No person has both combinations. Therefore, you have to have somebody to be able to open up that. You have to have two people to be able to open up that classified information and actually document what you've done, what you did, and once you secure the system so that there's a full accounting of the cryptography or the classified material. So anyway, what has to happen is the person that has classified information goes into a SCIF. A SCIF is a sensitive compartmented information facility. And they would have the legislators of your state, senators, representatives, a few from each. There would be a team that, and this would be a round robin duty that, you know, you would have a long-term body of legislators. I would think that you'd want to have them at least incumbent, but if an incumbent is, you know, lost and you don't have an incumbent or whatever, but there needs to be a round robin so that it's never set that the same people would actually go in and be get exposed to classified operations. But they would go into the SCIF and they would basically say, what do you got? Who are you? And what's going on? And this person would then divulge where they work, what kind of information they have, and then as that person basically provides the information to them and goes through these sources, these methods, these collections, these operations, and they upload these. In other words, this is not just done by this one team. In other words, however many, it could be a 5-man team, it could be a 7-person team, what have you. But these legislators would then actually take this and via a very secure encrypted network would actually transmit all of this data out to a SCIF in every state legislature. I want you to understand this. In other words, secrets are never kept with one person and other people managing it. When it comes down to oversight and saying this is an egregious violation of the Constitution, when NSA is collecting every single one of your conversations, that is a direct violation of our Fourth Amendment right. Every citizen should be protected unless there is a warrant signed and then they can collect that information. The fact that they just collect everything is unconstitutional. There's no question about this, folks. They do not have the authority. They can actually start collecting, but they can only do that upon the warrant. And I believe we need to help notify those people that, hey, a warrant has been served and you are now being monitored. Because that it's not about tipping somebody off. It is about actually being able to help exonerate a person and actually have that warrant removed. We have to start giving people the way our justice system is determined, innocent until proven guilty. So in other words, that person actually has to go and see the evidence provided for that warrant. it forces the dialogue. But back to this classified information. This classified information is either scanned or uploaded into a file, and it is copied, and it is then sent and transmitted to every state legislature. At that same point in time, as they're preparing all of this, a message is being sent out, because there will be an administrative assistant that when these people go in and somebody opens the door, steps out and out of the skiff and tells that administrative assistant that we have classified information that is being promulgated to the states. Boom. It is sent out to all of the state legislatures, and they're notified to find their round robin team to go into the skiff to actually look at this information. Then, as all of these 50 state legislatures are examining the data, they basically have and must determine that this is a breach of the Constitution, and therefore they need to provide by a majority vote. That's all they need, is by a majority vote of the states. If you have 26 states that say cease and desist and we want heads to roll, then it's done. Folks, we have to understand that the state legislatures are the parties to that compact. When you understand who has the ultimate authority over the Constitution, it is not the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has a function in overseeing those things within their jurisdiction on appeals, or those issues that can't wait for it to go through the appeal process. In other words, some things are just taken straight to the Supreme Court. But the only thing that should be in front of the Supreme Court are those things they have jurisdictions over. That's it. These issues of, you know, national lands, there's no such thing as national lands. They have no authority to actually sit over those things. This is why republic review is the only process. A constitutional convention, these folks over here that are deceiving you and because of your ignorance, remember that they're doing all of these things to us, and we're all being swallowed up by our emotions because of our lack of really understanding this compact. This is why we go through the ratification debates. This is why I painstakingly and I struggle in reading these things so that you can clearly understand, and don't take my word for it. Look these documents up. Read them. We provide them right there on the podcast page. Download them, and the link of the source document is right there in the document. You please prove me wrong. I am not here because my ego makes me feel good. I am here because I am doing a service. I am here serving this Constitution, as all of us should be. We all, as citizens of these United States, have a responsibility and an obligation, if you are capable of taking up arms to defend this Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. That is a birthright obligation you must fulfill. If you don't want that obligation, you must remove yourself from citizenship, and you'll no longer be able to vote, and you will no longer have any stake in this country. You will become an inhabitant, but that's okay. You'll still live under the blanket of liberty, but you won't have access to your rights under the Constitution. I am G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.